This study is going to be more, hopefully, on a discussion basis like we'd have at a Sabbath school lesson time. I hope you have your Bibles available, because I'm going to ask questions. We're going to check in the scriptures the answers. This study is a follow-up of the morning message. What does God say by fulfilling prophecy? Or what does God say through fulfilled prophecy? In other words, what is God trying to tell us? First, we must understand the relationships between Jesus' prophecies and God. There's a relationship between God and the prophecies of Jesus. And if we understand that relationship, we can understand better the answer to the question of what God is trying to say when a prophecy is fulfilled. Turn to Acts, the first chapter. And there in the first chapter of Acts, let us notice the sixth and seventh verses. Jesus is about to be taken up from them. He has been with them in various appearances. And so now it says there, when they therefore were come together, they asked of him, saying, Lord, will thou at this time restore again the kingdom of Israel? And he said unto them, it is not for you to know the times or the seasons which the Father hath put in his own power. See, they ask the question, will you at this time restore the kingdom? And the reason is very simple. He had promised them a kingdom. If you go to Luke 22, remember this is all in Luke. Acts. Luke wrote Acts and the Gospel of Luke. This is Luke's continuous concepts of being coming through. Luke 22. There in verses 28 to 30. Ye are they which have continued with me in my temptations, and I appoint unto you a kingdom, as my Father hath appointed unto me, that ye may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom, and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. This was a promise. They were going to be partakers in that kingdom. They were going to sit on thrones. Naturally, they were interested. Wilt thou at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? Because they looked to be able to sit on these thrones. But now notice what Jesus says. Go back to Acts and notice carefully what he says there in verse 7. We'll start at the bottom of the last part of the verse and work back through it. The Father hath put in his own power. The sovereignty of God is here brought to view. Now this word power, again, let me explain. In the Greek, there are two Greek words for power, translated power in English. One is dunamis, from which we get the English word dynamite, dynamic power, inherent power, and the other word is exousia, from which we get the word executive authority. All right, here is used the latter, exousia. The Father has put it in his own authority. The decision on the kingdom, the decision for fulfilling prophecies, the decision to fulfill events is the Father's authority. He gives the decision. Now, what does he control? It is not for you to know the times or the seasons. There's both of those words we talked about earlier. Chronos, chronological time, times, and seasons, kairos. In other words, the times, the continuation of time. How long shall time continue? That's the Father's authority. About the probation of various events and experiences during that time, the kairos, the seasons, that's the Father's authority. In fact, Jesus emphasized that even the time when he was going to return, he did not know. Notice what it says in Mark, the 13th chapter. Mark 13. Beginning with the 32nd verse. But of that day and that hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels which are in heaven, neither the Son, but the Father. Take heed, watch and pray, for ye know not when the time is. The final decision to send Jesus forth is the decision that the Father Himself alone will make. No man knoweth the hour, not the angels, nor the Son, the Father only. Now, Jesus gives the prophecies. Jesus gave the prophecies. On earth, recorded there in Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, prior in the Old Testament times, we're told that the prophets searched what manner the Spirit of Christ which was in them did testify. Gabriel told Daniel in Daniel 10:21, no man holdeth with me in the Scripture of truth but Michael, your chief prince. Then we come to the New Testament, the revelation. What is it? The revelation of Jesus Christ which God gave unto him to give. Jesus gives the prophecies. The fulfillment with their significance, the Father reserves in absolute authority to Himself. Here's the prophecy. At what time it is fulfilled, the Father determines it because He wants to tell us a message, a lesson. The Father holds it in His own hands. Now, how am I to relate to fulfilled prophecy? And when ye shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. Then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let them which are in the midst of it depart out, and let not them that are in the countries enter therein too, for these be the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. Now let's put ourselves and our thinking back to 66 A.D. And let's imagine we were living in Jerusalem. All of a sudden, we woke up one morning, and outside that city, around that city, the old city, were the Roman armies under Cestius. The Jewish armies were manning the walls. The gates of the city were closed. What would you have thought? How would you have reacted? You couldn't get out. No way! Would you have said, did I miss the sign? What happened before now? Here I am, trapped. And Jesus said, when you see these armies, get out. How am I going to get out? Now, faith would have said, Jesus' word is true. It will come to pass. The opportunity will present itself. If you had believed His word, then what would you have done until the opportunity opened? You would have made a preparation to leave quickly with all that was possible to leave as far as what was essential, so just as soon as the opportunity came, you could move. Right? Would you have spiritualized the prophecy? Fact, at that time, there was absolutely no Jewish church. I mean, no Christian church. They met in homes. They couldn't have surrounded a church. In other words, it was a city. It was a very literal situation. And they had to wait for that door, that gate to open. And when the gate was open, they had to move quickly, whether it be night or day. Now, how am I to relate to fulfilled prophecy? I am to be ready at a moment's notice to take the steps that prophecy fulfilled indicates. Whatever the circumstances, whatever the cost. That's the lesson from the message of Jerusalem. When a decision has to be made, be ready to make it, and make it quickly. You have no time to spare. The very life, the very literal life of those individuals in Jerusalem that believed the words of Jesus, their literal salvation was at stake. And it depended, everything depended, that they react according to what Jesus said in His prophecy. Now, this was only the first major aspect of Jesus' prophecy, the sign around Jerusalem. Now, interestingly, Luke passes over the other very quickly. In verse 25, he merely says, there shall be signs of the sun and the moon and stars. He just rapidly goes over that. In fact, Luke doesn't even talk about the days of tribulation. He doesn't even refer to the 1260 days. He doesn't even mention it. But Matthew and Mark emphasize that. Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of heaven shall be shaken. In Mark, the 13th chapter, in verses 24 and 25, you have almost an identical repeat of this particular message. Mark 13, 24 and 25. But in those days after that tribulation, the sun shall be darkened, the moon shall not give her light, and the stars of heaven shall fall, and the powers that are in heaven shall be shaken. So the question comes, what was God saying when he authorized the sun to be darkened and the stars to fall in 1780 and 1833 respectively? What was God trying to tell us? What was God trying to say? He said, look up. An event is about to begin. What event? 1780 came within the period of the 1260 days. 1833 came 11 years before what? 1844, when the judgment was begin. Where was the judgment to begin on earth? In the heavens. And the signs that pertain to the heavens were fulfilled prior to the beginning of the judgment in the skies. The pioneers of the Millerite movement thought in terms of the sanctuary on earth, and they missed it. They didn't miss the lying prophecy, but they missed the fulfillment of the event. If they'd understood the signs of the heavens and looked to the heavens, in fact, how much understanding prior to this time did men have of Daniel 8:14? You look through Froom's Prophetic Faith of Our Fathers and find out when the 2300 days was starting to be studied. It was not until they saw the fulfillment of the 1260 days in 1798 did they start turning their attention to the next date. Very little was understood. Who really brought it forth? No question about it, the prophecy was brought forth and studied by William Miller, and the impetus was given to the message of William Miller in the Falling of the Stars in 1833. Now, when God would begin to sit in judgment had been predicted. Under 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. In giving this sign, the sun and the moon and the stars, he was saying, look to heaven for the hour is approaching. And those who continued to look, what did they see? Even after the great disappointment. Those that continued to follow where the signs were directing and keep looking to heaven, what did they see? After the disappointment, what did they see? Who went through the cornfield? All right, and what did he see? What perception came to him? That there was a sanctuary in heaven and Christ moved his work from the first apartment to the second apartment. In other words, those that continued in the direction in which the signs were pointed understood the sanctuary and the message of the sanctuary and the beginning of the judgment. Now, in order to understand what they saw, where would they have to turn? What? The Bible? Whereabouts in the Bible? What? Well, they understood the 2300 days prior, but in the disappointment, where were they going to have to stay? In fact, even prior to the disappointment, where did they get the 10th day of the 7th month? The 10th day of the 7th month, they got back in the study of the types, didn't they? All right, so to understand what they saw in the heavens, they would have to go back and study what? The sanctuary in type, right? And so the basis of God's prophetic unfolding of the prophetic scroll lies within the study of the sanctuary. Follow closely. And he, referring to Aaron, the high priest, shall make an atonement for the holy. You will observe the word place is supplied, and in Leviticus 16, the word holy covers what we call the most holy place. All right, now follow carefully. He shall make an atonement for the holy because of the uncleanness of the children of Israel and because of their transgression and all their sins, and so shall he do for the inhabitants of the tabernacle of the congregation that remaineth among them in the midst of their uncleanness. The tabernacle of the congregation was what? The holy place. Now what was it that needed to be cleansed in that place? Exodus 30 verse 10, we find there in Exodus 30 verse 10 where Aaron is instructed that there on the at the time of the atonement, day of atonement, he was going to cleanse the altar of incense. That's the second step. Here. Now let's continue to read. And there shall be no man in the tabernacle of the congregation when he goeth in to make an atonement in the holy, until he come out and have made an atonement for himself and for his household and for all the congregation of Israel. And he shall go out unto the altar that is before the Lord and make an atonement for it, and shall take the blood of the bullock and the blood of the goat and put it upon the horns of the altar round about. The third step is what? The court, the altar there, because what has been placed on that altar? The record of the confession of the sins of the individual. On the horns of this altar was placed the record of the confession of corporate sins. Corporate, individual. But here, there was a mingling of blood. What blood was mingled for this cleansing? The blood of the bullock and the blood of the Lord's goat. Both were mingled for the cleansing of the altar in the court. Now, we do not have time this morning to go into the details of that particular aspect of the sanctuary, but this is important. The mingling of the blood of the two for the altar in the court for the cleansing of the record, or the record that is left here, the confession. We might mention this afternoon in the question period. It will depend upon you at that particular point of time. Now notice the 19th verse. And he shall sprinkle the blood upon it with his finger seven times and cleanse it, that's the altar, and hallow it from the uncleanness of the children of Israel. And when he hath made an end of reconciling the holy and the tabernacle and the altar, he shall bring the live goat, and Aaron shall lay his hands upon the live goat that's going to be taken off as the scapegoat. Now, my friend, when he has made an end of cleansing the holy, which is the most holy, the tabernacle and the court, and the live goat is brought, how much time is left for anybody? It's all over. The sanctuary teaches a three-step cleansing. Three-step cleansing. This is why I have placed it instead of the horizontal way that you're used to seeing it most, I placed it on the vertical way so that you can see the three steps as outlined here in the sanctuary picture of Leviticus, the 16th chapter. Now, let's ask ourselves a question. This altar, where was this brazen altar located? In the court. And what does the court represent? The earth. Now, don't miss that point. From the holiest place in heaven. And where did the judgment begin? Where were the signs pointing? Action in heaven, in the most holy place. Where does it end? On the earth. Step by step. One, two, three. Now, with that in mind, let's go over to Luke 21 and notice the emphasis. Luke 21, again. After briefly, as I noted before, different than the other two gospel writers, and there shall be signs of the sun and the moon and the stars. And where does he immediately go then? And upon earth, distress of nations with perplexity, the seas and the waves roaring, men's hearts fitting them for fear for looking after those things which are coming on where? The earth, and the word is the inhabited earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. That which is coming on the earth. Where is Luke's emphasis? On the earth. And what sign points to the earth? And Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the nations until the times of the nations are fulfilled. That sign directs immediately to the earth. For there shall be, as it says there, and upon earth, distress of what? The very nations that's being talked about in the 24th verse. The emphasis is on the earth. And so the prophecy that Jesus has given here that Jesus has given, that God has permitted to be fulfilled, is telling us that the last aspects of the final atonement have begun. And this is why the prophecy is so terribly important. We are being warned, as those were warned before 1844, that it was to begin. Now we are being warned that the final events of the final atonement are about to take place as far as this earth is concerned. Notice verses 6 to 12. Well, we won't even know, we won't read 6 to 12. We'll read just the 6th verse and the 7th verse. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to them that dwell on the earth, and to every what? Nation. Same word as Gentiles and nation in Luke 21. And kindred and tongue and people, saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to Him, for what? The hour of His judgment is come. The hour of judgment is connected with the very last messages to be given to a dying world. Because when these messages are ended, what's the picture in Revelation 14? The coming of Jesus Christ. The last message is connected with the scenes of the judgment. Now the question is, to whom did God commit this message? To whom did God commit the message of telling the world about the judgment that's taking place beyond the sky? What? Seventh-day Adventists. And this is a very, very important point that we need to know. Let me read it to you in Volume 9, page 19. Volume 9, page 19, and listen carefully to what it says. In a special sense, Seventh-day Adventists have been set in the world as watchmen and light-bearers. To them has been entrusted. What's the word? Well, how have we received the message? In a trust. Now, if you are a trustee and you are asked to take care of something as a trust, how do you relate? All right. To them have been entrusted the last warning of a perishing world. On them is shining wonderful light from the Word of God. They have been given a work of the most solemn import, the proclamation of the first, second, and third angels' message. There is no other work of so great importance. They are to allow nothing else to absorb their attention. The most solemn truths ever committed to mortals have been given us to proclaim to the world. The proclamation of these truths is to be our work. The world is to be warned, and God's people are to be true to the trust committed to them. No study, no seeking to understand our relationship to the church today dare avoid the concept of this trust. Any decision made by any individual must take into account this trust. God committed a trust to this people. And that trust was a third angel's message based in the concept of the judgment, the sanctuary. Volume 8, page 247, a warning after 50 years. In fact, this is written April 21, 1903, just about 11 to 14 days after the 1903 General Conference session. This is what it says. In the balances of the sanctuary, the Seventh-day Adventist Church is to be weighed. This is not saying perhaps. This is not saying maybe. This is a specific statement that God doesn't play with. In the balances of the sanctuary, the Seventh-day Adventist Church is to be weighed. She will be judged. Now remember, when it talks about she, it's talking about a corporate body. The feminine is used. She will be judged by the privileges and advantages that she has had. If her spiritual experience does not correspond to the advantages that Christ at infinite cost has bestowed on her, if the blessings conferred have not qualified to her to do the work entrusted to her, what was entrusted to her? The three angels' message, a sacred trust. Now if her spiritual experience does not qualify her, Let's see, wait a minute. Does not correspond to the advantage that Christ had infinite cost has bestowed upon her, if the blessings conferred have not qualified her to do the work entrusted to her, on her will be pronounced the sentence found wanting. By the light bestowed, the opportunities given, will she be judged. Now these are plain statements that cannot be contradicted. We received a trust. We're going to be weighed in the bounds of the sanctuary. After all, where's the final work being carried forward? The heavenly sanctuary. And we're going to notice another aspect of it. We've noticed three here. And if we do not, and if the church does not line up with the trust, she will have pronounced on her what? Found wanting. Now, we come to some questions. We're in a now time. The determination of whether this has been fulfilled speaks to us just as surely as the fulfillment of Jesus' prophecy in 66 A.D. In other words, on the basis of what it says here, we have some decisions to make the same as they had to make in 66. If we determine that she has been weighed and has not proved capable of carrying out the sacred trust, then what conclusion do we come to? The decision is found wanting, and we have to make a decision. But remember, it has to be on this basis. Now, if that decision has not been made, then there is a continuing work that needs to be going on, has been going on for the last 146 years. In other words, business as usual. Either she has been found wanting and is no longer business as usual, or she's not found wanting and it's business as usual. There's no way around this thing. We're there. A prophecy has been fulfilled, and we have to determine what it means. A commitment was stated, and we need to understand what it's all about. Now, the fate of the nation and the fate of the church are tied together. Both are corporate entities. Second verse. Open ye the gates, that the righteous church, which keepeth the truth, may enter in. Is that what it says? Open ye the gates, that the righteous nation, which keepeth the truth, may enter in. But my friend, who will enter in? Those that keep the truth, the righteous church. Now let's notice another one. Turn to New Testament. Ephesians, the second chapter. Galatians, Ephesians, second chapter, verse 12. Notice what it says. Speaking to the Gentiles in that Asian province, Paul writes, at that time you were without Christ, being aliens from what? The commonwealth of Israel. Is that a religious expression? What's a commonwealth? I know there's one state called the Commonwealth of Virginia. What does that refer to? The corporate state of Virginia, the commonwealth. The Commonwealth of Massachusetts. All right, here's the Commonwealth of Israel. They were alienated from the Commonwealth of Israel and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and with God in the world. But now in Christ Jesus, ye who sometimes were far off are made nigh by the blood of Christ. Made nigh to what? The Commonwealth of Israel. In other words, the church that Christ established was considered by as a commonwealth, a corporate body. Let's go on down further. Verse 16. That he might reconcile both unto God in one body by the cross, having slain the enmity thereby. 19th verse. Now therefore ye are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens. Thus the fulfillment of the prophecy Jesus gave tells us that the second phase of the judgment had ended and that we passed to the final activity in the court. Now let's follow this. In the type, first in the holy place, most holy, then in the holy place, and this had to do with corporate. When this ended, Where did he go? To the altar in the court that had to do with the individual. If the times of the nations, the corporate body is up, their days of visitation is over, where's the judgment passed to? It passes now to the altar in the court. Now, what is God saying in that fulfilled prophecy of Luke 21:24? That no longer is he dealing with the nations as corporate bodies or the churches as corporate bodies. He's dealing with the individual in an individual relationship. And I want you to notice the picture now in Ezekiel 9. Turn to the 9th chapter of Ezekiel. Let's notice verses, the first four verses. He cried also in mine ears with a loud voice. A loud voice, a loud cry. Loud voice, loud cry. Saying, cause them that have charge over the city to draw near. What's the city? Even every man with the destroying weapons in his hand. And behold, six men came from the way of the higher gate, which lieth toward the north, and every man a slaughter weapon in his hand. And one man among them, different from the others, was clothed with linen, with a writer's inkhorn by his side, and they went in and stood beside the what? Where's the brazen altar? In the court. This is the hour of the brazen altar, in the court. And what is he told? And the glory of the God of Israel was gone up from the cherub whereupon he was to the threshold of the house. Where is the glory of the Lord? The cherub. Where's that? The most holy place. And where did he go? To the threshold of the house. And he says something to this group that's standing here at the brazen altar. And what does he say? And he called to the man clothed with linen, which had a writer's inkhorn by his side. And the Lord said unto him, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and cry for all the abomination that be done in the midst thereof. The sealing time. The last work. The sealing time of the 144,000. All proceeding from the brazen altar. But who's this man clothed in linen? Go back to Leviticus 16. Notice the fourth verse, Leviticus 16. Leviticus 16, verse 4. And he shall put on, this is Aaron, the holy linen coat, and he shall have the linen breeches upon his flesh, and shall be girded with a linen girdle, and with a linen mitre shall he be attired. These are holy garments. Therefore he shall wash his flesh with water and shall put them on. On the Day of Atonement, what did Aaron put on from the top of his head to his ankles? Linen. In the final atonement, he's clothed in linen. When you go to Ezekiel 9, the man with the writer's inkhorn is clothed in what? There's one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. That man clothed in linen is instructed to go in and put a seal upon those that sigh and cry in the midst of Jerusalem. And you come to the end of the chapter, he comes back and reports, I have done what thou hast said. And remember, in the type, the blood of the goat, the Lord's goat, and the blood of the bullock are all mingled at the altar of the court. God and Christ unite together in the final atonement. And this prophecy is telling us that we've reached that hour, the hour of the time of the final atonement, and this is where we're living. How can we set aside a prophecy that has so much import to us in this very hour connected with the sanctuary and say that it has none effect? It doesn't mean anything. We get our eyes moved to this and we get our eyes moved to that and this interpretation of this and this interpretation of that and this interpretation of Ezekiel 9 and something else. All diversionary from the very message of the sanctuary that God's trying to convey in fulfilled prophecy. The judgment, having passed to the court and to the cleansing of the guilt and the stain of the individual, how ought we to be living? How ought we to be living? Turn to Leviticus, the 23rd chapter. And on the 10th day of the 7th month, What day is that? The Day of Atonement. There shall be a Day of Atonements, plural form in the Hebrew. It shall be a holy convocation unto you, and ye shall afflict your souls and offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord. And ye shall do no work in that same day. And I want you to keep in mind that every other one of the feast days, it says ye shall do no servile work. Certain things were permitted. But when it came to the Day of Atonement, the law was as mandatory and as strict as anything about the Sabbath. In it thou shalt do no work. And so on the Day of Atonement there was to be no work. And that means simply that you are not to trust to your works. For can a leopard change his spot? Or an Ethiopian his skin? Then how can ye that are accustomed to do evil do good? We're told there in the Testimonies to Ministers, page 508, divine grace is needed at the beginning, divine grace at every step of advance, and divine grace alone can complete the work. You and I cannot try to bring our own works into the picture and try to achieve a perfection that God alone can bestow through His power. Ye shall do no work therein. For is the Day of Atonement, to make an atonement for you that before the Lord your God. For whatsoever soul is it that shall not be afflicted in that same day, he shall be cut off from among his people. And whatsoever soul it be that doeth any work in that same day, the same soul will I destroy from among his people. Ye shall do no manner of work, it shall be a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwellings. Here is the command that God gives us in the light of the hour to which we've come. Affliction of soul. The time spent in foolishness must now be appropriated to soul searching and the study of the Word. It means simply that we have to reorganize our whole life and our whole program. They did in Jerusalem in 66. They had to decide in 66 when those Roman armies were around Jerusalem what they could take with them and carry, that which was essential. And that which they'd accumulated to be left behind for the destruction. It was a rendering decision. It was a tearing decision. It had to tear them away from all that was their life and their very experience because they were going to go out in an unknown. Likewise, today there must be a tearing away of that which has been near and dear to us and realizing that out there, the unknown, with God alone, only that which is essential will stand. How shall we live? How shall we do? What should we be? These are important questions, and unless we understand the prophecy and the importance thereof, we're going to be tangled up with fable and with false interpretations, and we're going to make some wrong decisions. God has given this people the prophecies of His Word that are true, every one of them. He's given us the sanctuary message which we alone have been in possession of. We need to understand both and put them together and not go into a lot of speculative interpretations and even false historical facts in order to try to justify actions that we feel ought to be done. Indeed, this is a solemn hour, an hour in which to be living is sublime. But how are we going to relate to it? What are we going to do? Are we really studying the Bible as we ought? Are we really doing what we need to do? You know it says of that group that are finally sealed that in their mouth was found no what? What is that word guile? It's pseudos. Falsehood. For they are without fault before the throne of God. Now if in their mouth was found no guile, what have they got control of? Their tongue. Absolutely, the tongue. And those that are able to control the tongue are the same as a perfect man. But the tongue can no man tame. You know, our tongue sometimes fly like it's loose on both ends and hardly held down in the middle. Tragic situation. If we just do a little thinking, a little studying, we would control our tongue. O Lord, set a guard at the door of my mouth. And some of our jesting, and I'm involved in that, and some of our foolishness that I have been involved in, must stop. The whole order of our lives must change, because we're standing at the hour when we're going to face an eternal God. Holy, holy, holy. And if we're going to be in His presence, there must be a transition, a change in our lives. May we be willing to heed the prophetic message. Jesus gave a prophecy. God let it be fulfilled. And He was telling us something. Let us respond to what He was telling us. And let His life be lived within us. And so would we sing, can we sing that prayer, "Live out thy life within me, O Jesus, King of kings. Be thou thyself the answer to all my questionings." Where it speaks about the Shekinah glory now shine forth from within. And let us just then be humble, gentle servants, moved only as by Him. That number is what?
279.